It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. If I tell you that an associate professor of anthropology at Johns Hopkins has written a dual memoir with his 95-year-old grandfather and that it describes a life shaped by the great wars and movements of the 20th century in South Asia and across the globe, if I tell you that, you may conclude the book is dry and abstract and has nothing to do with you. So let me quickly tell you also, I found the story of M.P. Mariapin's life completely engrossing and found it reflected a bit of my own family's history from a completely different part of the globe. The memoir is Aya's Accounts, A Ledger of Hope in Modern India, and its co-author, that Johns Hopkins anthropology professor, Anand Pandian, is with me in the studio to tell us about it. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Your grandfather, M.P. Mariapin. Let me ask you to pronounce your grandfather's name.
M.P. Mariapin, though we all call him Aya.
And Aya means what?
Aya simply means father in Tamil.
And is it common to call an older gentleman?
No, not at all. I was the oldest grandchild in the family, and my grandfather and grandmother had 8 children, and I heard them call my grandfather Aya, Aya, which means father, father, and apparently I picked it up myself as a grandchild, and somehow the name stuck, and everyone in the family knows him now as Aya.
And tell us just a bit about him to get us started. What should we understand about him?
Well, my grandfather is 95 years old. He is a retired fruit merchant living in the South Indian city of Madurai. And in many ways, he lives a very simple life at this point. His habits, what he does on a daily basis, they don't take him very far from the neighborhood in which he lives. But as is the case for so many people of his generation, he's had a long and rather extraordinary life. And over the last couple decades, I've had a chance to explore some of that with him, which is what this book is in a sense about.
Aya doesn't know precisely where or even when he was born, but
That's
he's
right.
very clear on many things, including a really key experience when he was a young man, he and thousands of other Indians leaving Burma as refugees as Japan invaded Burma at the start of World War II. Tell us what happened on that trip.
Well, my grandfather, he grew up in a small village in South India, but as you said, he actually doesn't know whether he was born in that village or whether he was born in the small town in Burma where his father had a small grocery store. There were many Indians at that time during the British colonial period who had migrated to Burma and taken up jobs of one kind or another, including many from the part of India where my family comes from. When the Second World War broke out, he was a young man who was managing this small business with a couple of his brothers, and like hundreds of thousands of other people of Indian descent, he had to make his way back to India for fear of what would happen. The bombers were approaching where they were living. There was tremendous chaos on the ground, and in the tumult of their flight, the one trunk in which my grandfather had carried the details of his actual birth was left behind in Burma.
You write of him telling you about literally the cart that he and his brothers put together to take a few things home and take themselves home, rolling over the bodies of refugees who had essentially died of thirst or diarrhea from drinking polluted water. And he tells you that to this day he regrets someone they left behind.
That's right. My grandfather was one of approximately 200,000 Indian refugees who took one particularly treacherous route through the Arakan Mountains in western Burma down to the shore from where they caught a ship that took them to the port city of Calcutta. However, that first part of the journey, which involved a long trek through the mountains of well over 100 miles, was an incredibly deadly passage. Historians estimate that somewhere between 10 and 50,000 people who took that route actually perished along the way, mostly due to waterborne illnesses of one kind or another. And my grandfather speaks very harrowingly of walking beside these bodies, of their the wheels of their cart riding over these bodies, of having to cook and sleep beside these bodies. Such was the extent of suffering along that way. There was a tremendous amount of official neglect when it came to the plight of these refugees. There was just one British officer stationed along that entire route to look after these 200,000 refugees. And as you can imagine, that didn't help very much in terms of what was happening at that time. And of the people that left with my grandfather, there was one man in particular who also got sick along the way. And my grandfather and those who were with him made the very difficult decision to leave him behind, with the thought that if they brought him along, they may not make it themselves. And that decision, that act of betrayal, is something that remains with him to this day, some 60 or 70 years later.
That's Anand Pandian, Associate Professor of Anthropology at Johns Hopkins, here on Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about the memoir he wrote with his grandfather, Ayah's Accounts, A Ledger of Hope in Modern India. Let me ask you about caste. Ayah is a member of the Nadar caste, considered a disadvantaged class. You describe it with phrases like toddy tappers,
that's right,
tree climbers. Tell me about this caste.
That's right. Well, when we think of India, we often think of caste, and we often think of caste as something that's fixed, that's been the way it's been for all time. But one of the things that we now know about the history of caste in India is that there has been a tremendous amount of dynamism, a tremendous amount of historical transformation in the position of particular communities in relation to each other. And this caste, the Nadar caste, is emblematic of that kind of history. From what we can tell with regard to historical documents, it appears that most people from this particular community made their livelihood a few centuries ago with the products of one particular palm tree, the Palmyra palm, which they would tap for the sap with which they would make country sugar or jaggery, but then which they would also allow to ferment and turn into country liquor. And this association with I guess you could call it a kind of bootlegging. This association with country liquor is something that had given this particular community a bad reputation and association with a kind of ritual impurity that left them toward the bottom of the caste hierarchy. But one thing that began to happen in the 19th century is that through a confluence of a whole series of social transformations, the rise of a Christian missionary activity in that part of India, a movement into the new market towns that were developing in that part of India in the 19th century, and a movement into commerce, new forms of collective organization that gave the caste a way of organizing to transform their condition in new ways. Members of this community actually wound up attaining a great amount of social prominence and respectability by the 20th century, to the point where people from this particular caste don't even remember how badly off they were.
I was most struck by your description of your grandfather in recent years taking his daily constitutional and counting the steps. Why does he count the steps?
Well, that's a great question. I think that one of the things that I've learned as an anthropologist is that there are extraordinarily interesting details buried in everyone's lives, even in the most ordinary of lives. And it takes the right kind of attention, the right kind of questioning to ferret out those details. And if I were to try to make sense of that, I would say that for someone like him, it has to do with a life led as a merchant, of having to count out fruit of various kinds by hand, by fives, for years on end in the bazaars in which he worked. And there are ways in which those habits or practices that we develop in our working lives come to be resources with which we make our way in the world. And I think this is an example of something like that.
But I also almost had the sense that he said he wanted to focus so much on every step in the present to not let his mind wander to memory.
That's right. That's right. That's right. I mean, you've got to imagine what it must be like. It's difficult enough for me to do so, having spent this much time with him. But what would it be like to have spent 95 years on this earth and have gone through all the things that my grandfather's gone through? His being orphaned, losing his mother as a very young child. This movement from this small village in India all the way to Burma, growing up there, then coming back as a refugee back to India, somehow making it from that village to this new burgeoning market town in South India, Madurai, making a living as a merchant, having eight children, losing one of them along the way, then seeing several of them go to the United States to pursue other livelihoods, having grandchildren come and then go and come back, and all these things happening over so many decades. They have stayed with him, and they continue to stay with him, and they stay with him to the extent that they somehow sometimes keep him up at night, just the thoughts. And so this is a way for him of keeping focused on the present and not losing himself entirely to the past.
Let me pose the question you ask yourself very near the end of the book. Why pay such close attention to the life of someone so ordinary, so unknown?
That's a great question. I think that's a question that cuts to the heart of this strange enterprise that I've landed in, this business of anthropology. And I think that it's very easy for us to assume that because a life looks ordinary, it looks very commonplace or typical from the outside, that we have nothing to learn from it. But one thing I've come to understand as an anthropologist is that there are extraordinary, transformative, moving, gripping stories that all of us carry, and that the right kind of attention, the right kind of engagement, the right kind of focus and work can bring those stories out. And in the case of my grandfather's life, I think that though we have focused on the life of one person among over a billion in this place we call India, there is perspective in his life on events of vast global significance, such as the Second World War, such as the Great Depression, such as the kind of imagination of development that captivated so many people in India and other countries in the post-war years. One of the extraordinary things for me about working with my grandfather on this story is the way that this experience has taught me the value of paying attention to individual lives as a way of opening into larger concerns such as these.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Anand Pandian, Associate Professor of Anthropology at Johns Hopkins. He'll be speaking about his book, Ayah's Accounts, A Ledger of Hope in Modern India, at the Ivy Bookshop on Falls Road on Thursday, 7 p.m. We've got information about that event and about the book on our website, wypr.org/Merlin Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you've been listening. Back with you Wednesday.
Merlin Morning is an original production of Your Public Radio, WYPR, in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy and Jamila Kay. Nathan Sterner directs and engineers. We have production help from Brandon Block, Alexandra Kennedy, and Justina Latimer.
You can learn more about what you've heard on our show or catch something you've missed on our website, wypr.org/Merlin Morning.
I'm Sheila Cast.
And I'm Tom Hall. Thanks so much for listening. Have a great day.